Okay, turn to page 1 in your folders in Matthew, the 4th chapter. We'll look at a passage in there and also one from John chapter 1 when we get started just in a moment. We start the Sermon on the Mount this morning, and our goal is to get this done by the end of May. We may have to stay a little longer, a few class periods to do that, but we'll work on that and see if that's not maybe the case. I think we'll go somewhat slower at the start, and then once we at least clear verse 20 of Matthew 5, we can at least pick up the pace a little bit through the rest of chapter 5 and group the verses together. Not just to do it for time's sake, but I do want to try to get done by the end of the school year if we can. Okay. We received good news about Brad. He does not have to have a skin graft. Doctor said that this morning, and his therapy will only have to continue through the end of this week. That puts him in good shape for school starting next week, so we're glad for that. Thank you all for your prayers for him. The Peppers are out. Both Buddy and Cornelia are sick with whatever's floating around, so that's why they're not here this morning. Anybody else we need to pray for? Yes. Okay. Rusty Miller surgery this morning. Forgot about that. Let's pray for him. Anybody else? The Colliers? Yeah, Mary went and saw the Colliers yesterday. Sarah started to cry, she said, so they're really having a hard time right now, feeling rather depressed and blue about their situation. We don't want to forget about them. Carolyn Miller? Treatment's tomorrow. Okay. Anybody else? Ben and Wilma? Yes. Did you see the email from Gary on Eastsiders yesterday? They went and saw them after church Sunday night and said, Wilma, this does not look good at all. She's just so feeble right now. Ben was here Sunday morning. I don't think he was here at the night, or do I have that reversed? He was here in the morning, not at night. They're just so aged and so feeble. Not much good for them right now either. Anybody else? Sister Dawes is still with her heart. How are her ankles? Did they ever get better? Okay. All right, Sister Dawes. Okay. All right. So many people to pray for. Brady, would you lead us in prayer before our class begins, please? Amen. How many times have any of you studied this sermon? Many times? It's a great classic text, these three chapters of Matthew 5, 6, and 7. I began the material by looking at some historical speeches. And of course, I'm not trying to liken the Sermon on the Mount with a political speech. But when we think about addresses or public speeches, there have been lots of speeches given in history that have been memorable for one reason or another. These four I just picked here, there could have been a whole lot more of us that we could have chosen, have propelled men on to what some would be, some would say, well, that made that person great, or that really illustrated or demonstrated the greatness in such one. Notice, for example, Lincoln's Gettysburg Address was only 267 words long, but it's one of the most famous speeches in all of American history. President Obama's recent economic speech was like 6,000 words long, and whether or not you agree with his politics, you see the contrast between how men deliver oratories on one subject or another. So history is laden with great speeches, obviously, but there can be no greater cause than the kingdom of heaven. And looking at the Sermon on the Mount, of course, Jesus did a lot of public teaching. This isn't his only public teaching. But it may be the only thing we would label as a sermon, in that it covers a broad subject matter and details the different parts about it. You know, we could look at Matthew 13 and his seven parables by the sea. But that was parabolic teaching. This is actual sermon material. And it's an address, if you will, that talks about the kingdom, talks about those who need to be in the kingdom, what kind of people do they need to be, what the king's expectations are of the kingdom citizens, all these things. And then, of course, the consequences for obedience and disobedience to the laws of the king. So this speech is about the nature of the heavenly kingdom. The kingdom of heaven, we'll see, is that the king himself came to deliver its laws. Notice in Matthew 4 and verse 17, this is, of course, before you even get to the sermon itself, Satan has tempted Jesus by this time, and so after that is over, he then begins what we've come to call the Galilean ministry, starting in verse 12. Verse 17, from that time, Jesus began to preach and say what? The message is repentance. Why? The kingdom of heaven is at hand. It's coming. How important was it for how important is the gospel of the kingdom? Notice in John chapter 1, I heard a preacher make this point one time, and I thought it was worthy of thought. John chapter 1, verse 17, the opening verses of John's gospel that talk about the pre-earthly existence of Jesus. He was in the beginning. He was with the Father. Verse 17. Larson, read verse 17 for us in John 1, please. All right, some versions say we're red lines. Some versions say grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. The point the preacher made was, notice it says that the law was given through Moses. And it was. Moses was the mediator of that dispensation. But grace and truth came. Jesus brought truth with Him. It's that important. The law was given to Moses from heaven. But Jesus brought truth with Him when He came to set up the kingdom. So it's important enough that the King Himself came to deliver the laws of the heavenly kingdom. And of course, as we know, the New Testament church, it just isn't come up as a thought once Christ got here. How long had the kingdom been in the mind of God? From the dawn of eternity. This kingdom was always in the mind of God. So the Son of God finally came, and then in this sermon, He is dispensing its laws. He's dispensing its characteristics, if you will. And so this sermon emphasizes the nature of this kingdom and the righteousness that's to be found in its citizens. Sadly, though, it's misunderstood and malpracticed by so many people. Looking now at the middle of page 1 here, some of these points I think are worthy of commenting on. Many people reject it out of hand. They don't even consider it at all, saying, well, it's just, some of this is just not even doable. That doesn't make any sense. It's logic standing on its head, so to speak. For example, Matthew 5 and verse 29. Now, we'll examine these words in their context when we get to that part of the sermon, but just looking at that one verse real quickly. What is the force of the language Jesus uses there? What's He saying? About your right hand or your right eye. Yeah. Now someone says, now surely He doesn't. And of course, we know Jesus does not mean this literally. But see, they point to verses like that and say, see, that's illogical. That makes no sense. Why would anybody do that to themselves, whether it's physically or metaphorically? Well, unless you understand what true kingdom righteousness is, and what is demanded of repentance, then this will seem illogical to you. Verses 38 through 42 of Matthew 5, looking at those verses together, Jesus is talking about what? He says, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth. But I say to you what? Don't resist. And somebody slaps you? on one side, turn your head, they can slap the other one.
And someone says, no, that's not how we operate in this world.
Rather, they'll go along with verse 38. You take mine, I'll take both of yours. You take one of my teeth, and I'll take five of yours. You know, we're all about revenge. But Jesus is telling us, no, that's not how we operate in my kingdom. Then, of course, the closing verses in chapter 5, what about, you've heard it said, you shall love your neighbors and hate your enemies. Well, what did the Lord say about your enemies? You need to pray for them. Someone says, now how many people actually do that? Well, if you want to be in this kingdom, you better learn to do it. That's what the king expects of you. So there's just some real quick ways in which people just reject the sermon at all, totally. It's not practical. It's not logical. It's not even doable. No one prays for enemies. So that's one way it's misunderstood. Others abuse it by taking some of the truths that are found in this sermon and only applying them in social reform settings rather than talking about personal transformation. And what do I mean by that? Well, look at chapter 5 and verse 9. These are the Beatitudes, which may be the most familiar or famous section of the sermon. But Matthew 5 and verse 9, Jesus said, blessed are who? The peacemakers. Someone says, well, yes, that's talking about people. We have a president or we have an ambassador, we have whoever. And they just fly around the world and they are trying to broker peace in the Middle East and they're trying to get the nations that have warred together for 4 or 5 centuries and they try to bring peace because after all, what did Jesus say? Blessed are the peacemakers. Well, I'm not opposed and none of us should be opposed to having world peace. But do we know if that's what Jesus meant or not? I don't think that's what He meant with that statement. We have Matthew 10 to tell us. I did not come to bring peace. And He means earthly peace, worldly peace between men. Not that the Lord doesn't want that, but that's not what His kingdom's about. And then in chapter 7, 1 through 5, a passage that's often just yanked out of context and kind of waved around in front of people. Judge not that you be not judged. And we've heard that used, in our age of tolerance. We've got to love the homosexual. Well, we've got to love the homosexual. But that means that we can't pass judgment on him or on her because, after all, Jesus said. So we need to set our social policy for this nation upon the Sermon on the Mount. Well, Jesus was not talking about there's prohibition on all judgment. That's not what he meant. What kind of judgment was Jesus talking about there? Hypocritical judgment. That's it exactly. Because you start looking at someone with this little splinter in their eye, while at the same time, what's coming out of yours? Great big 2x4. That's right. A beam. That's hypocrisy. So the Lord said, do not judge someone until you first get your own house in order. Then you're able to see the speck or the splinter in your brother's eye. So we see how some people use the sermon. And we want to make sure that, first of all, we understand it in the way the Lord delivered it. And secondly, we want to make sure that we apply it properly in the correct setting. Now, can we use the Sermon on the Mount or principles from it in being a better earthly kingdom, being better citizens? Well, we could. But let's keep in mind that that's not its primary focus. That's not why the Lord delivered this great speech. He's got higher objectives in mind when He preaches this sermon rather than the ways that people use these verses sometimes. All right. Every kingdom has a charter, or someone would say every kingdom has some defining documents, and that is true. Our kingdom, this really isn't the kingdom we live in, but it's a political realm. Anybody been to Washington, D.C. and the National Archives? What have they got on display up there? They've got the defining documents of this country. You can see the Constitution. You can see the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights. You can view all that. That's our defining documents, if you will. This sermon, I think, can be viewed as the charter to the heavenly kingdom. You will know anything at all about the king himself, about his kingdom, and really what's most helpful to us would be about kingdom citizens. Good place to go to the Sermon on the Mount. You can learn all that you need to know about how to be pleasing to the king and living in this eternal kingdom. So let's look at some of these points. This takes us to the bottom of page 1, on over to the top of page 2. In Matthew 5, verses 3 through 12, that's what we call the Beatitudes, and I know the Bible doesn't call them that. The Lord didn't call them that, but that's what they've come to be called. That will describe kingdom citizens. And then verses 13 through 16, what we've come to call the similitudes. That is, what are we likened? To what are we like, if you will? To what are we compared? All those 14 verses that open the sermon describe the citizen, he or she, what he or she should be like. Then we look at what true kingdom righteousness is. This is what Jesus expects of righteousness. Now, as we go through that section, we'll see, like in verse 20 of chapter 5, Jesus said, unless your righteousness, so see, we're supposed to be a righteous people, unless your righteousness do what? Exceeds, go beyond, surpasses the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, what's the consequence? Unless that happens, you won't be in this kingdom. You won't be in the final rewarding state of this kingdom. Well, did the scribes and Pharisees have righteousness? We're supposed to exceed what they had. Did they have any righteousness? They did, but what kind of righteousness was it? Self-righteousness, man's right, pompousness, focus on self. And that will be abundantly clear when we go through verses 1 through 18 of chapter 6. Jesus will tell us then, here's the kind of righteousness they've got. And you've got to do better than that. You've got to go above and beyond that if you want to be in my kingdom. So, would it be fair to say that Jesus sets the bar high? Well, it's a high bar set, but is it attainable? Absolutely it's attainable. It's doable. And we can exceed their pompous self-righteousness. What about issues like faith and trust in God? Great familiar passages in chapter 6, 25 through 34, about being clothed and being fed. Don't be anxious. Don't worry. Maybe the theme verse of the entire sermon. It may be chapter 6 and verse 33. What did Jesus say? Seek first the kingdom and His righteousness. And then what about these things that we may be all worked up in the lather and worried over? He says, they'll be added to you. Don't worry about those. You'll have what you need, but seek my kingdom first. Chapter 7, verses 7 through 11, talks also in a different way, sort of, about faith and trust in God. Those three statements, ask, and it shall be given to you. Seek, and ye shall find. Knock, and the door shall be opened to you. And those three verbs, ask, seek, and knock, are in the present active tense in the Greek, and that means you keep on asking, you keep on seeking, you keep on knocking. There never is a time when you don't do those things if you want to be in the kingdom. So Jesus teaches us about the importance of that, having faith and trust and complete dependence upon God. About treating others right. The bulk of the sermon, thematically wise to me, seems to be verses 21 through 48 of chapter 5. All those statements where Jesus says, and there's six contrasts. You've heard it said, blah, blah, blah. But I say to you, blah, blah, blah. Well, we need to understand what Jesus meant by that. Many have the idea that when Jesus says, well, you heard it said, and He doesn't always quote Moses in those statements. Sometimes they are quotes of Moses, but sometimes they're not. But you've heard it said of old, such and so, that the Lord was saying, well, you know, they kind of had it wrong back there. Let me set you straight about that. Well, I know that's not what He meant because of the verses that precede verse 21 in Matthew 5. Jesus never shows a disdain for the law. In fact, He says in Matthew 5 and verse 17, think not that I came to destroy the law. That's not why I'm here. Why did I come? I came to fulfill it. The law was good. So Jesus never saying, yeah, they really messed that up back there. Let me see if I can straighten this up for you now. That's not what He meant. And so we'll go through that great section. And those verses teach us how to treat others right. So kingdom citizens, though we are members, citizens of an eternal kingdom, you and I involve ourselves in earthly relationships, don't we? We have spouses, we have children, we have friends, we have enemies. And how are we? We have employers or employees, we go to school, we have neighbors, whatever. All right? Well, how are we to act in those relationships? Well, we have to act a certain way to be a member of this kingdom, to be a citizen of this kingdom. So Jesus talks about all that. And then toward the end of the sermon, He tells us how important it is to obey the King. And if we had to ask some little children, do you know anything about the Sermon on the Mount? Well, they would be able to tell us right quick. I think even Grant could back there. Sing little songs, particularly verses 24 through 27. The two kinds of men, the wise man and the foolish man. And they built their houses. And those closing verses really teach us the importance of obeying the Lord and how He feels about that. Okay, we're going through this rather quickly, I know, but we're just kind of getting an overall sense for the sermon. This sermon could be easily preached today. It would be just as timely. And I mean literally, somebody would get up here at this podium and preach this lesson just the way the Lord preached it. It would be just as needed today. And that's because we know, Ecclesiastes says, chapter 1, 9 through 10, there's nothing new under the sun. He says, Solomon says, what has been done, what about that? Well, it's going to be done again. Because we're not inventing anything new. There may be different, new invented ways to sin, but it's still the same sin. And we're still doing the same thing men's always done. So this needs to be preached. The themes and the points that are emphasized in the sermon need to be preached just as much today. We still have fleshly pursuits. Did Jesus address that in the sermon? He absolutely does. He addresses it directly. We are to deny ungodliness and worldly lust and live soberly and righteously and godly in this present age, Paul says, Titus chapter 2. Peter says to abstain from fleshly lust, which wage war against the soul, 1 Peter 2 and verse 11. We're taught about the inferiority of human wisdom, and Paul talks about that in 1 Corinthians 1, 18 to 25. These are passages listed here on top of page 2 in your material. And Jesus again tells us. Here's what I think in this sermon about the emptiness and the shallowness of human wisdom. Again, that's describing the scribes and Pharisees and their view of righteousness. And Jesus just blasts it away in the lesson, in the sermon. Shows us just how bad and pitiful and empty that is. Men are to be persuaded. Paul says, we persuade, knowing therefore the terror of the Lord, we persuade men. Well, this sermon seeks to persuade. Look at the bullet points top of page 2. As someone who writes sermons every week, I try to live by this, and all those who try to preach the gospel, I think, need to do the same thing. This sermon does what all good sermons should do, and it does it. And by that, we're not shocked because Jesus is the greatest preacher. Not to make Him on par with us, I mean, but He was the greatest ever who taught a lesson or preached a sermon. The sermon informs us of things that we may not know. It's new to us. I've never heard that preached before. Or maybe I've just never really considered that before. And listening to a sermon, listening to a discourse, would bring those things to mind. Second bullet point, it instructs us in ways that we already know. Reminds us. Yes, down deep, that is right, that is true. Brethren who come here every week and they sit in their assigned spot, we all have our pews we sit in, and they hear the gospel preached, more times than not, will they hear anything new? Not likely. Not likely. Well, then why would they come here and enjoy coming here and keep hearing things they already know? Why would brethren want to do that? Why would we like to do that? That would seem, on the surface, using worldly wisdom, that seems kind of boring. Peter says, I put you in remembrance of things even though you already know them. But what about the age-old gospel story and the disciple who's in this kingdom? Does he still like hearing it? He likes to hear it. Because he knows, she knows, what it's done for him or for her. We like to hear the old story. We never tire hearing of that. Preacher told me one time, he said, Jeff, in your preaching, just follow this rule. He says, if it's new, it's not true. And if it's true, you finish it. It's not new. That's right. He's right. If it's true, it's not new. But if it's new, it is not true. It's not the gospel. No, it's absolutely not, Ralph. You are correct. There's no recent revelation. This is an old story. No additions to it. That is correct. So this sermon does those things. And a preacher would do well to pattern his preaching after the way the Lord preached this sermon. Yes, he does. Which is that there is no different gospel. You're right. That's right. That's right. Galatians 1 talks about that very thing too. You're right. Okay. Well, let's look now at the setting of the sermon. And this, to me, is not as important to know when he preached it and from where, but it is worthy to consider. It may help set in our minds the ministry of Christ if we can come up with some ideas as to when he taught it. When you hear the phrase, Sermon on the Mount, well, you think automatically that's Matthew 5, 6, and 7. But don't forget about Luke 6, 12 to 49. Now, we'll not use the Luke 6 passage in terms of our material, enough that we won't refer to it, but we're going to use as our outline and our guide Matthew 5, 6, and 7. However, when you look at the four Gospels, which Gospel record gives us the best chronological account of the Lord's stay on the earth? It's Luke. Luke does that. And we learn some things looking at the text in Luke that may help us know, okay, when did Jesus preach this sermon and possibly from where did he preach it? Let's consider these. I think we can say with certainty that if you look at the Lord's public preaching, his public teaching, he was on the earth for 3+ years, and some students, and I think this is helpful, at least it's helpful to me, some have divided the ministry of the Lord up into 3 1-year periods. There was the year of obscurity. That was his first year of preaching. He was an obscure figure. Nobody knew much about him. He just was an unknown. But he came working all those signs, remember. And how did the signs that he worked, the miracles, help him with his popularity? Oh, it skyrocketed. That's right. Then he became a known figure. Now that was a popularity that Jesus never trusted in. He didn't put any stock in it because he knew he had other things to tend to. Man would take that and eat that up, and it would mess everything up. But the Lord didn't put any stock in that. But it seems that Jesus preached this lesson in the second year of his preaching work, what has come to be called the year of popularity, when he was a more popular figure. And I think Luke gives us his chronology. So let's look at Luke's gospel real quickly. We won't spend a lot of time on this, but turn to Luke. And you see the bullet points there toward the middle to the bottom of page 2 is where I got these references. In Luke 4, verses 14 to 15, Jesus returns to Galilee following his temptations at the hand of Satan. And that tells us that he went back to Galilee. You'll see there in Luke 4, and you see it there in verse 14. Returned in the power of the Spirit to Galilee, and the news of him went all throughout the surrounding region. So see, he's a popular figure. His image is growing, if you will. In Luke 4, 16 to 30, we have the first rejection at Nazareth, when Jesus said, a prophet is not without honor, except where? When he's home, that's right. When he's home, they know him. That's that little boy that grew up, and we don't think much of him. We know all about him. He's not really impressed with us. He was rejected at Nazareth twice, Matthew 13 being the second one, but this is the first one. And then we see that he heals many in Capernaum, Luke 4, 38 through 39, including, who did he heal when he was at Capernaum? Peter's mother-in-law. She was one of them. So that was early on in his ministry, if you will. Then in Luke 5, 1 through 11, and then 27 through 32, we have the calling of the first disciples. The first group of disciples came from what occupation? They were fishers. And it seemed to be two sets of brothers. It was James and John, sons of Zebedee, and also then Peter and his brother, Andrew. So they were commercial fishermen. 27 through 32 of that chapter, Jesus walks by a business office. And who's sitting there at the table? Levi or Matthew. He was a publican, a tax collector. Jesus says, come follow me. And he left that business and followed him. So Jesus is calling the early disciples. Now, they're not yet apostles. He's just calling the first group of his followers. And from all these followers, Luke 6, 12 through 19, you see in that text. Look particularly at verse 13 of Luke 6. Well, let's before we get to that verse, verse 12. It came to pass in those days that he went out into the mountain to pray, and continued all night in prayer to God. Now, there's a quick lesson for us. When you have an important decision to make, what do you need to do? You need to pray about it. Jesus did. He prayed all night before he picked these disciples, these apostles. Now, verse 13. Yeah, and keep on praying. That's right. Now, verse 13. When it was day, he called his disciples to himself. This is how Luke writes it. And from them, that is the group of followers, he chose the 12. And then he lists them for us here in this text. So he then selects the 12, what we call the apostles, or the ones he will send out. Now, that's where we get to when he then launches, as Luke writes it for us, into the Sermon on the Mount. So this is what we've come to call, using the Waldron's books, which we do here for our curriculum, it's the Great Galilean Ministry, is when he spoke this. That's how we can fit all this on a timeline, if you will. So most likely it appears that Jesus delivered this address from somewhere near Capernaum in Galilee. And it appears it was on a mountain, so traditionally speaking, and this is not really critically important, but a lot of commentators will say, more than likely, it appears that Jesus delivered this address from the Horns of Hattin, which was a double hill that was west, just west of the Sea of Galilee. Here's a quick map. Of course, there's the Sea of Galilee right there. There's Capernaum. And so somewhere to the northwest of the Sea of Galilee, around about right in there, there was this range, if you will, and it was a double hill. It's called the Horns of Hattin. I've got some photographs off the internet. Here's the double hill as it's seen from one view. And then here's another view. You'll see them there in the background. This is the best view. Right there's one of them. And so how many were there, we don't know. But you can just imagine. Now, does that mean that Jesus climbed all the way to the top? I don't think that's what that means. But as you can imagine, a hill like that, he could ascend up to a high enough place where he would have somewhat of a platform, if you will. And the people were kind of down here on the hillside there, kind of spread out there. And how many of it was that he addressed, there he preached, it seems. There he preached this great sermon in that year of his preaching. So I thought those photographs may give us just kind of a picture in our mind. Now, do we have to know where he taught it? No, we don't have to know that. Do we have to know when? No. None of that detracts. Not knowing those does not detract from getting the sermon, but that may give us just a little bit of an insight into as to when he preached it and from where. Okay, now let's look at the outline of it. I said this sermon is like all other sermons. And any sermon, any good sermon has a structured outline. And I think that's important. I try to outline all my sermons. I think the audience needs to be able to see the main points. Needs to be easy to follow, that while it's being presented or preached, the audience can see, you know, the way this is being delivered and the way it's arranged, there's a logical progression of thought. Well, I will tell you, this sermon has that kind of thought, that kind of outline. It's got that kind of structure. And it's just a masterpiece. And, of course, we would expect no less from the great teacher. How does the account conclude? Now, Jesus has finished preaching by Matthew 7, verse 27. But as Matthew writes this, Ralph, read for us, please, Matthew 7, 28 through 29, the last two verses of these three chapters. Just the last two verses. They were astonished. They could not believe the kind of preacher that he was. Later on, and this just came to mind, look in Luke 7 and verse 46. Jesus was always, of course, he was being sought by the council, being sought by the Jews. And the council sent men to go get him, go fetch him, bring him under custody. And these men came back empty-handed, John 7. Verse 45, then the officers came to the chief priests and the Pharisees, who said to them,
Why have you not brought him? We sent you out there to apprehend him and bring him back. What was their answer? Verse 46. We've never heard anyone speak like this man. He's just different. There's something different about him. Now, we cannot speak like the Son of God. We don't have that ability. He's God in the flesh. He's omniscient. He has tools available to him that we'll never have. But when we speak his word, like if we preach the gospel truth, and someone out there in the world may hear it for the first time, shouldn't they be somewhat astonished? You know, I've never heard anything taught like that before. That's different than what I'm used to hearing. And so, Jesus shows us in this sermon, he's the greatest teacher, command always of his facts and his presentation. A lot of preachers today, you see some on TV, they're all about substance. Excuse me, they're all about style. I said that wrong. They're all about style. There's just no substance to it. It's just empty. This preacher was all about style. Well, not so much all about style, but he had style too, but there was substance to his teaching. There was reality and truth about it. And we are, when we consider the great gems that are found in this sermon, this text, we just are amazed at the simplistic truth and the power behind these sections, if you will. So I want us to consider not just, okay, Matthew 5 and then 6 and 7, but I want us to consider the sermon in its points. And I think we can see them. And you'll see there on page 3, I got these from Brother Earnhardt. They're somewhat revised, but the main points are his. And he has studied the sermon for years. Good material. So we'll first talk about citizens in the heavenly kingdom. That's Matthew 5, 3 to 16. And that's what seems to be Jesus' focus. Excuse me. Once he finishes that, all right, then from Matthew 5, 17, the rest of 5, all of 6, and then even into 7, at least through verse 11, to talk about the righteousness of heaven's kingdom. What does it mean to be a righteous person? What is required to practice and to possess true kingdom righteousness? I believe that's the second main section of the sermon. And we'll see that in example upon example when we go through it. And then thirdly, in Matthew 7, 12, 27, you have on more than one occasion, Jesus gives an invitation to this kingdom using more than one example. So citizens who are in it, the righteousness of it, what's required of it, and then the invitation to it. And then the verses that Ralph just read, the last two verses, the teacher himself, how he's described there at the close of it. That is the Sermon on the Mount. That's a rather simplistic way to outline it, but I think it's true to the text. And that'll be the one that we use. You probably could look at other works written by men and come up with different outlines. I'm sure you could, but this is the one that we're going to choose to use for our studies. Okay, that's quickly lesson one. Any comments or questions anybody have before we get to the actual text on page 4? Anybody? Speak now. Or forever hold your peace. Okay, lesson two. Now let's look at the citizens of heaven's kingdom itself. Describing people, talking about people. Citizens in any kingdom. Citizens of our republic. We don't have a kingdom where we have a king and a queen, but we are still a kingdom of sorts, an earthly realm. We must live in ways and be people that please the king. And this sermon begins with that kind of description of the characteristics that Jesus desires in those who would be citizens in his kingdom. And we call them the Beatitudes. Again, as I said before, Jesus does not say, now, please hear the Beatitudes. That's not, he doesn't say that. But that's what they've come to be recognized and known as. The first question here on page 4, I ask you, how much does Jesus discuss the standards by which men's happiness, quote, unquote, happiness, is usually measured in this sermon? How much does he talk about those things listed in parentheses? None. They're not important. John 18, verse 36, he says, my kingdom is not of this world. All right? So the things that
people say, okay, let's just do a little joint thinking here. If someone were to ask, go out here on the street, let's do a man on the street, ask the question, what makes you happy? If you could pick the kind of life that would make you happy, what would you pick? What do you think people would say? What kinds of things? Money? Gotta have more money. All right. Material wealth. Hit the jackpot. What else? Health. Yeah, I don't want any health problems. I don't want to ache. I don't want to have any operations. I don't want stuff like that. So I want to have perfect health. Always be healthy. All right. Okay. Yeah. Usually we say happiness is the absence of anything sad. I don't want any sadness in my life. So I don't want any problems. I want to get along with everybody. I don't want any adversity. I don't want any how else could you describe it? Tough times, things like that. Well, Jesus talks about that in this sermon. Somewhat. We'll see bits and pieces of it here and there. So see, when we try to describe the happy or blessed person, typically man uses different criteria than the Lord uses in this lesson. Ralph, you going to make a comment? Yeah, right. That's right. Life is just so good. That's it. We have our perspective. Now, citizens in this kingdom need to think beyond this world, but just people in general. Ralph's point is correct. We just have we have blinders on, and we just have tunnel vision. We just think, well, it's just all about right here. And so when you're talking about, when Jesus says, blessed or blessed is all these kinds of people here, verses 3 through 10, or 3 through 12 rather, happy is this person. Well, man would say, yes, but you know, the kind of happiness I'm really wanting, it usually would not jive with what the Lord is saying here. So Jesus doesn't talk about them a little. He doesn't talk about them at all. The usual standards by which we use to measure men's happiness. The word beatitude, it comes from a Latin word which means consummate bliss or happiness. Blessedness. That's why students have through the centuries said, well, okay, we're going to call these the Beatitudes, because Jesus says in each verse, blessed is the whatever, or happy is the such and so a person. So we'll call them the Beatitudes, being a truly happy person. Spiritually happy. Now, look at these traits. This is question three. Are these characteristics, what we're going to look at in this section, are they hereditary? Or the product of environment? Things like hereditary. You know, your hair and your eye color. You get your DNA from your parents. But you have no control over that. That's just what you get. Your looks. Those kinds of things. They're not based on an inheritance, if you will, from mother, father, grandparents, whatever. Are they also the product of one's environment? These characteristics. He talks about the one who, let's just list them right quick. The one who's poor in spirit, the one who mourns, the one who is meek or gentle, the one who is who hungers and thirsts for righteousness, the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemaker. We're to be that kind of person. Okay, do we get that because we dwell in a certain kind of environment? The answer is no. They're not the product of environment. Let me illustrate this for you. Tammy's sister, their other daughter, Tanya, she and her husband adopted two little boys from Russia. What, about 3 years ago? Is that what it is? Three. All right. Now, we remember the night we met them at the airport in Huntsville. They flew in, long flight from Moscow. They finally got to bring them back to America. And I can just imagine the shock in those little boys as they saw this. All this was just new, totally new to them. Well, as they started living here, do you think they're going to start speaking Russian? Well, they're born in Russia. I know somebody would ask them that. Now, when they get older, would they speak Russian? Not likely. Well, how come? Why wouldn't they speak Russian? Because their environment is America. They're going to grow up in the South. They took them to a home in Tennessee. Now they live in Madison, Alabama. So they will grow up and probably speak Southern. They will. Not just English, but they'll speak Southern English. All right? See, that's the problem with environment. You go to New York or New Jersey, all right, and talk to somebody. Well, how do they talk? They're Yankee. They don't talk like we do down here. See, that's the product of one's environment. You live somewhere long enough, you begin to take on the attributes of that culture. But not even these characteristics. No, they're not the product or the result of just being exposed to a certain culture or environment. That's not where they come from. The question was asked, are they that? This is question 3. So if it's not these things, and I think this is really important for us to realize at the start, before we even get to the text itself, we must see this. If it's not these things, then where do these traits come from? They are conscious choices. You must choose to be this kind of person. Now here's where we get to some of the problem. They are entirely self-willed. And they're chosen. Jesus said in Luke 14 about counting the cost. You've got to know what you're getting yourself into when you want to come follow me. You better know. Now, someone says, okay, let's go back to Matthew 5 now. Look particularly at verse 4. You mean to tell me, this is a little devil's advocate, but I'm going to ask it anyway. You mean to tell me that for me to be a truly happy person, I've got to choose to mourn? What does that mean? That means, yes, you have to choose to be a mournful person if you want to truly be happy. And what's our culture say about that kind of thinking? That's crazy. That doesn't make any sense. How could you be happy if you choose to be a mournful person? Well, it depends on what you mean when you say, blessed are those who mourn. How many times have you heard this passage used at a funeral home? I've heard it used several times. I'll tell you, it's got nothing to do with physical death. That's not what he was talking about. It's something else he's discussing. We've got to understand what the Lord is meaning here. Yes. Even an all men will mourn, but will all men be comforted? The answer is no, they won't. Not with what he's talking about here in the sermon. So, Ralph, you are correct. Even an atheist will cry and mourn. So these traits are entirely self-willed and they are chosen. A person chooses to be spiritually poor. He or she chooses to be mournful. He or she chooses to hunger and thirst for righteousness. What if these things don't appeal to you? Let's just cut it right down to its bare level. What if you don't choose to be those things? Then what does that mean? You will not be in this kingdom. Yeah, this is not a kingdom for you if this doesn't interest you. You'll miss it. It's just that simple. That's what the Lord is talking about. Okay, so I want us to remember that as we go through the Beatitudes here. Now, also looking in question 4, are these, this is my phrase, are these competing factors? And by that I mean, we have a group of kingdom citizens here. We got let's fill this room up. We got 300 people in here. Okay. Well, now this group back there, they're the peacemakers. Over here, these are the ones who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Is that how it works? No. How many do you have to have? You got to have all of them. This describes the composite Christian. I've got cited on the material here and also on the chart. In 1 Corinthians 12, we know Paul was talking about the spiritual gifts that existed in the first century among disciples. And just paraphrasing, he says, now there are many gifts, but they are this one Spirit. And the Spirit will dispense or give gifts according to His own will. To one is given the gift of whatever. So in that context, those gifts, they were, I don't want to say that they were competing
factors because they weren't meant to be. That's how the Corinthians were using them. They're making a contest out of it. Well, my gift's better than your gift. You know, I can speak in tongues. If you interpret tongues, you depend on me. So that kind of thinking. But in that situation, those gifts were dispensed differently among different people. Not everybody had all the gifts. But in this situation, we're talking about, no, the Christian, these verses describe the disciple. And if you possess one, or to possess one, is to possess all of them. And if you lack one of them, then how many do you really lack? You lack all of them. Really, you do. Someone says, well, you know, looking at verse 3 of Matthew 5, blessed are the poor in spirit, the one who really sees his spiritual poverty. What if you don't do that? Then can you possess what's in verse 6? No, you can't. If you lack one, you really lack all of them. You got to have every one of them. And so Jesus teaches us that. Here's the kind of person who's going to be in my kingdom. And if you possess these qualities and we understand them in the correct way, then you truly will be the happy person, the blessed person that is in my kingdom. Okay. The kingdom citizen, and this hopefully describes you and I, we're different. We need to be different in what we think, in what we value, what we admire, what we see as valuable, what we seek, what we want. We need to be submissive, not self-righteous. Remember, not the pompousness of the scribes and Pharisees, but we need to be submissive. Submissive to who? Well, God first and foremost, but anybody else? Christ? Anybody else? What if you're a woman and you're married? You got a husband? Civil rule? What about the local church? To elders? See, this idea of submissiveness, it runs all throughout all of our relationships. You can't get away from it if you're in the Lord's kingdom. You can't be self-righteous. One, he will come to God and he'll be aware of his own failures. He knows, you know, I've really made a mess of things. And I need something, I need someone. Someone once wrote, I'm not sure if he meant this to be a flattering statement or a condemnation. He says, it seems to me that the religion of Christ is for losers. Well, really? That's the truth, isn't it? We've messed up. We've just made a mess of our lives trying to do it our own way. And we've come to realize, you know, I need God. I need His will. I need His way about doing things. And so the kingdom citizen knows that. He's very much aware of his own emptiness, his own shallowness. And so he tries to be this kind of person that Jesus describes for us, at least through verse 12 of Matthew 5. Yes, Robert. Yeah, the need for mercy and grace is not there. You are correct, Ralph. I think that's the point that Paul makes in Romans 4, for starters, comparing justification by works rather than by grace or faith. All right. The kingdom citizen is not mighty. He will not obtain what he wants or what he needs by force. I'll just go out there and take it. Or I'll be duplicitous or deceptive. Kind of, shrewd in my actions. And I'll just kind of be the politician and work the crowd against one another. And I'll take advantage of situations and work it all to my... The citizen doesn't do that. He can't do that. That's not his nature. He is patient. He is kind. To who? Everybody. That's the kind of person he is. He is totally and wholly dependent upon God. He has rights. We all have rights. But he doesn't demand them. Rather, he'll yield his rights to the needs of others. And would he be feeling like he's made to do it? No, he'll do it gladly. He'll do it gladly. That's the kingdom citizen. When we talk about being a member of the Lord's kingdom. Now, looking at, before we get to question 6, this is just kind of a summary statement here.
Most of the Beatitudes are about self. And these are not verse numbers. These are, I've just numbered them in order. Numbers 1 through 4 takes us verses 3, 4, 5, and 6. And then also number 6, which would be verse 8. So at 5 of them are about self. A couple of them, 2, seem to be emphasizing how we view other people. Not ourselves, but someone else. All right? So that's 7 of them, and there's only 8. And the last one, only one, is about how the world views him. The last one, how does the world view the kingdom citizen? I think Jesus addresses it. Verses 10 through 12. There's disdain, isn't there? There's persecution. And what did Jesus say? Blessed are you. I'm telling you, you will be a happy person if you draw the ire of the world and its contempt. Now, someone says, that doesn't compute to me. How in the world can I be happy being the object of scoff and rebuke from the world? Well, how can you be happy? Absolutely, Peter and John were. You will know that you're living the way you ought to live. That's right. And you'll also know that you have whose approval? You have God's approval. That's right. And you think about that, that'll make you happy. That'll make you happy. So, see, we're talking about things that just run much deeper than just skin level. I mean, this goes way down into what is really true and what is really right. So, of the 8, 5 of them are about self, 2 of them are about how we view other people, and only one seems to be in the reverse, that is how the world or others look at us, how they view us. Okay. We got time to cover one, and then we'll have to stop here. We're going to cover them now in order. Matthew 5, verse 1. Seeing the multitudes, he went up on a mountain, and when he was seated, his disciples came to him. Then he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, here they start now. Verse 3. Blessed or happy are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. All right, the poor in spirit. I've asked the question, what is meant by poor in spirit? This is question 6, bottom of page 4. What's that mean to be poor in spirit, do you think? All right, humble, not self-serving. Self-assertive, self-serving, all right? All right, what else? All right, he's not full of himself. All right, his need for salvation. Very good. Spiritual health. Anything else? That's it, Washington. I think that's it. He realizes, I am bankrupt spiritually. I am impoverished. I am destitute. Now, Jesus never emphasizes, though he does talk about some of these things in this sermon, but make the analogy, the physically poor versus the spiritually poor. All right, what does the physically poor person know about himself? Pockets are empty. I've got no money. He knows he's in need. How's he going to get anything? What's he going to have to do? He's going to have to beg, isn't he? Well, he's going to work. But assuming he doesn't have a job either, I mean, he's got nothing. He's going to have to beg. He's living at the mercy or the generosity of somebody else, either one person or a group of people. He's totally at their mercy. So to be spiritually poor means to be spiritually impoverished. It means to be bankrupt. Ralph said it recognizes my need for salvation, and I think that's what we're talking about here. All right, this is a spiritual quality. It's to be totally aware of one's need for God. Now, you can't be in the kingdom unless you adopt that kind of mindset. There's no place for you in this kingdom unless you're poor in spirit. Poor men are desperately needy. They know they can only beg. And I know, again, that we're not talking about the physically poor, but let's look at some of the statements that we can find that kind of help us think this way. Look in Luke 16 with me, verses 20 to 21. We'll have to stop after we talk about this. Luke 16, 20 through 21. This is the story of who? Rich man Lazarus. All right. Verse 19. There was a certain rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen, and he fared sumptuously every day. How would you describe his life? Just with that one statement.
Oh, wait, that's right. How does it get any better than this, Ralph? That question you asked earlier. That's right. He lived great. That's right.
Living the dream. But, verse 20, there was a certain beggar named Lazarus, full of sores, who was laid. And that's important. He didn't lay himself. He had to be carried. He's dependent on every need of his life is dependent on someone else. He was laid at his gate, desiring to be fed with what? I'll take the crumbs. Forget the loaf. Forget the piece of bread. Just give me the crumbs that fell from the rich man's table. And if that's not bad enough, he's in need of physical relief because of his sores. And who does he depend on? He depends on the dog to come by and lick his sores just to give him relief from physical pain. See, poor people, physically poor people, they are desperately needy. They don't have to be told, you know, I think you're poor. And I think you need to know that you don't, you have no one to help you for your needs. You need to beg. No, they know that. They don't need to be taught that. That's the kind of person we need to be. Not physically, of course. But the metaphor is to be poor in spirit. To be a citizen in this kingdom. Okay, our time is up. We'll have to stop with that. We will pick up in the Lord willing next week. We'll finish up the last part of question 6. And then move on to page 5 and talk about the other Beatitudes. Thank you for your good comments. I hope you're going to enjoy the class as much as I will also. I do have extra folders. If you didn't get a folder and need one, I'll be happy to bring you one before you leave this morning. Thanks for coming.